More than a decade ago, researchers in a limestone cave on the Indonesian island of Flores unearthed the bones of an ancient race of tiny humans, now in sandstone laid down by a stream 700,000 years ago. They found what appeared to be the creature's ancestors, a partial lower jaw and six teeth belonging to at least one adult, two children. The importance of the remains outweighs their number. They suggest that dwarf humans roamed the island, hunting pygmy elephants and fending off Komodo dragons for more than a half a million years, an amazing discovery. Up next, we'll talk more about alternative archaeology. Paul Rimosh with us next on Coast to Coast AM. Now, what a background for our guest. Paul Rimosh is an author, couple books, The Lost Mine, The Lost Stones. Now, let me tell you about Paul. He graduated with a bachelor's degree in forensic science. He has worked as a crime scene investigator for Weber Metro CSI for the past 19-plus years. He has certifications through the International Association for Investigations in Fingerprint Examination, Forensic Photography. He is currently serving as a chairperson of the Western Identification Network Latent Fingerprint Committee. He's also an adjunct professor at Weber State University in Utah, and is very active in the training of law enforcement officers and crime scene investigators. Paul, what a background. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me back.
It's been 3.5 years, I think.
Yeah, it has been a little bit.
A long time. What have you been up to in 3.5 years?
Well, been busy, busy as usual. Have a growing family to raise and take care of. And then I wrote, since I've been on with you before, I wrote the sequel to my first book. And then I tried to do a little bit of stuff in my profession. I wrote an article for a forensic science journal that got published, and then I wrote an article for the Ancient American magazine published by the great Wayne May. And so I've just been trying to do some different things.
Gosh, well, I want to talk with you about so many things, not only alternative archaeology, but what you've been doing in the forensic science field. It's just fascinating to see what forensic scientists can do to try to solve some of these crimes with whatever clues are out there. It's truly amazing what you do.
Yeah, we have some good tools, and we're getting better stuff all the time, so it's an exciting time to be in the business.
How did a forensic scientist get involved with, I guess you would say, alternative archaeology?
Well, I blame you and your show.
Thanks.
Well, it's interesting. My day job and half the year my night job, deals with, courts of law and provable facts and things like that. Mm-hmm. My interests have always really tended towards alternative things. And you think that those two things might not line up, that they might not jive with each other, but in actuality, they really do, because a good investigator, a good detective, or a good crime scene investigator has to go into every investigation with an extremely open mind. So the investigator who trained me, his name is Russ Dean, and he's a professor up at Weber State University as well. He always warned us about tunnel vision. And the way he taught us to investigate scenes is to go in and have really no preconceived notion. You go into a scene, you just start looking around and observing and taking notes, mm-hmm. taking photographs and just looking at things. And you don't, like I said, you don't have a preconceived notion of what happened. But then as you look more at the facts and put things more together, then you start getting working theories. But those theories you aren't married to. You're just, you have some working ideas, things you're bouncing off your crew.
Sure.
Trying to do. And then, it's not till very late in the investigation that you really make up your mind as to what happened. And when we look at some of these alternative things out there, that's what the great minds in the fields that you cover do. We just had Jim Mars on, or you talk about Graham Hancock or any of these guys, they don't have preconceived notions. They just follow the evidence. They would make very good crime scene investigators.
They would be. They're very detailed oriented.
They are, and they don't get hung up. And it's interesting, as I've studied the ways to kind of approach things, there's two ways that, well, there's more than two ways. There's two kind of predominant ways to gather knowledge or to approach a problem. One is called induction. And that's what I just talked about, where it's a bottom-up approach, where you just look and you're not making any decisions right away, but you're just gathering that knowledge and learning and putting it all together, and then you come to a conclusion. And then there's deduction, which the mainstream of sciences really cling to. It's the scientific method that's often really pushed, where you have a theory first, and then you go about looking at and trying to prove that theory. And you're supposed to have intellectual flexibility that if your theory isn't matching your facts, that you give up on it and move on. But the trouble is a lot of mainstream scientists have what's called anchoring, where they have a theory and they get anchored to that theory and they're not going to let it go no matter what else comes their way. And that's a problem, because we get new evidence for things all the time, and you have to have that intellectual flexibility to let it go.
Paul, we've got probably one of the highest listenership of people incarcerated in jail.
Yes.
And I also believe law enforcement listens to us a lot, don't they?
Oh, they do. And so many police officers and security guards listen to the show and look forward to it, really, because on those dark and lonely night watches, I mean, the radio, talk radio,
it's their friend.
In particular, it's interactive and it's engaging. It's not just listening to music. It's not just, you know, kind of mindless. It engages you. You think about it. You talk back to the radio sometimes. You know, it's so engaging. There are a lot of people. And, you know, to those prisoners who are listening, I have to say, go thy way and sin no more. That's all I have to say.
Exactly. And, you know, and I'm sure it helps that we support police as much as we do on this program.
Well, you were open to all sides.
Absolutely.
And most police officers out there are people who believe in the Constitution, they believe in gun rights, they believe in all the things that are really espoused on this show. Unfortunately, the mainstream media loves to focus on the problems and the bad ones out there, where the vast majority of them would...
The vast majority are great guys and women. Yeah. They really are. Good people.
And they believe in the Constitution wholeheartedly. Yep. Our sheriff always passes out copies of the Constitution and says, here, read this.
That's good. Now, you've been doing crime scene investigating for 19-plus years, right?
Yeah.
What has been the strangest, weirdest stuff you've come across?
Well, it's funny because, you know, there's kind of a lot of different categories of things. One of our main things is death investigations, and the decompositional process can be really horrific, and I won't really go into any details there.
But I can imagine.
Ugh. Yeah, we had an interesting case last, well, I think maybe it was two summers ago, and Glynis McCants, your
the numbers lady,
she might love this story, because I got called to a death investigation. A woman had been walking down the street, and she had just expired on the side of the street.
Just died right there.
Yeah, just died right there. And she was older, and she wasn't in very good health. She had just come from the 7-Eleven, the 7-Eleven where we always hang out, you know, our 7-Eleven. And she had just come from there and bought a few things. And when we went and talked to the clerks later, they said she was sweating profusely and breathing really awkwardly when she was in line. And, you know, it was just, there wasn't anything suspicious about it. It was just kind of a medical thing, I'm sure. But, and that's what the autopsy showed as well. But as we were going through her stuff, and, you know, it's just kind of weird. Here's this woman just dead on the side of the street, and the neighbors are peeking out of their windows, wondering what's going on. You know, I took my pictures, we investigated, the medical examiner came and did his thing, and we got her loaded up in the transport to go down to the autopsy, and kind of as an afterthought, her bag was there, her 7-Eleven bag, and I'm like, well, we better go check, see what's going on in that bag. And when I took out the receipt, the to- total for her purchases was $6.66.
Not her day.
Yeah, it's like, oh, well, she got this receipt and then was dead just minutes later. And it's just one of those funny things.
Jeez. You do come across strange things. There's no doubt. I've been told that on full moons, police get called to very strange episodes way more than normal days.
Well, and not even just strange episodes, just more of everything. We had a full moon just a few weeks ago, and one of my partners, Jason, he was working alone that night, and you know, normally, you know, for our area, one crime scene investigator can kind of handle everything, you know, the different calls that come in.
But sure.
It was a full moon, and he'd had over 15 calls, and there was a shooting and all these things.
He's overwhelmed, right?
Yeah, he was overwhelmed, and he sent out a text, hey, you know, I need some help, and we all went out and helped. And it was just one of those nights, and I look up, and I'm like, there's our problem right there. And I don't know how much research has been done on it, but you talk to people in ERs, you talk to the paramedics, talk to people in law enforcement, and that full moon, you just dread it when you see that it's on your shift.
Just fascinating work that you do. And when you're on a crime scene, what are some of the first things you look for, Paul?
Well, for us, there's a definite process that you go through. And as you know, I was taught by my mentor, Russ. He always pushed being systematic and thorough. And in part of the process of being systematic is you just want to go through certain steps every time. And so for us, the first thing that we do when we get on scene, whether it's a pretty, you know, simple call or, you know, a complicated double homicide, is we want to take photographs of that scene in its pristine state as much as we can. You know, obviously, if the paramedics have been in there, they might move things around, or if the family comes in and discovers a victim, you know, they'll do things. But we want to try to get our pictures done as quick as possible, as in as pristine a state as possible. And that's just so we can document everything as is. Because as we go through, then we might start marking things with our yellow tent markers or moving things around. But that first step is to get everything all documented with photos and sometimes video as much as you can. And so that's really our first step. And then you just, like I described earlier, you just start making small observations. You don't try to be Sherlock Holmes and walk in and sniff the air and have the whole story. You're just making these small little observations. And that's basically called, in the business, event analysis, that you're not looking at everything all at once, but you look at, say, okay, you know, the lamp tipped over onto the coat. So we know that the coat was on the ground before the lamp was tipped over. And then you just go and piece all those little micro events together, and then you get the story in the end.
With the TV shows like CSI and programs like that, do you get a kick out of watching them, and how realistic are they?
Oh, I could only suffer through the first episode and a half of the very first series because it was so overblown and so it's just when people ask how accurate the show is, I say, well, it's like comparing today's NASA with the Starfleet in Star Trek. That's about the comparison. Just the technology they have, the resources they have, just a lot of it doesn't exist. A lot of it's blown out of proportion. And, yeah, so it's not very accurate. And it's a double-edged sword. I mean, a lot of really good young people have become interested in the forensic sciences because of those shows. And so, you know, it's in a way injected some fresh blood in us. But also, it's caused what is called the CSI effect. And what the CSI effect is that a lot of times in jury trials, people who should have been convicted because there was good cases against them are getting off because the jury thinks, well, the police didn't do everything that I see on TV, and so they must have botched the case, or they must have not done a thorough job, even though the things that they see on TV are overblown or don't even exist. And so one of our favorite examples from the show that we talk about in some of the classes that we teach is there was on the original series, someone had been stabbed, and they poured this silicone casting material into the wound. Ugh. And then pulled out the exact shape of the knife. And when we saw that, we're like, oh, no.
Pretty innovative, though, isn't it?
Well, I guess it's inventive for the writer, but it wouldn't work that way. I mean, you know, once a knife goes in, you know, it's not a wax block. I mean, there's a lot going on with your internal organs and your bones and compression of the skin and all that stuff. You would not get this exact copy of the knife. It's just ridiculous.
So how did you make this transition into some of these archaeological areas like the lost mine, lost stones?
Well, like I said, a lot of the inspiration for my books has come from the wonderful guests that you have on your show. I mean,
Thank you.
My brothers, Dave and Dan, got me onto your show right about the time you started full time.
2003.
Yeah, that's about right. So they had listened to ARC for years, and you know, they told me about the show, and so I started to listen more and more about the time you took over. And so, you know, you hear some of these guests, and it's just the stuff that they have to say is mind-blowing, and it goes back to the way I'm trained to think as a crime scene investigator. You know, you don't have opinions that don't change, or you shouldn't have these preconceived notions. You need to follow the evidence. And so, you know, when you hear someone like Graham Hancock or David Hatcher Childress talk about their discoveries and the things that they talk about, you're like, yeah. It makes so much sense as it goes on. And so, but my inspiration for The Lost Mine, the book we'll talk about tonight, that came from my old scoutmaster named Larry.
Really?
Yes. So
he must have told you a great story.
Oh, he was a great storyteller. He was a great scoutmaster. And so we would often go camping, and our scout camps were in what are called the Uinta Mountains in Utah. And so the Uintas are a very interesting mountain chain, and that most mountain chains in the U.S. kind of run up and down, you know, north to south.
Right.
But the Uintas actually run east to west. And if you think of the state of Utah, it kind of looks like a bench, you know, it's kind of blocky, but then it has that little corner out of it where Wyoming sits. And so the Uinta Mountains kind of run under that bench in Utah. And they are a really cool mountain range. And a lot of, like, thousands of lakes and, you know, all these peaks everywhere. The highest mountain in Utah is in this mountain range. But there are also tons and tons and tons of legends surrounding these Uinta Mountains. And one of the ones that Larry, my scoutmaster, always told me about were these hidden and secret gold mines that were in the Uinta Mountains that were guarded by the Native Americans.
All right, let's pick that up when we come right back, Paul. Fascinating. Gold mines guarded by Native Americans. I want in. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Paul Rimosh with us. A couple of his books, The Lost Mine, The Lost Stones, of course. So the scout leader tells you about the legends of gold mines. Pick it up from there, Paul.
Okay. Imagine you're a 12, 13-year-old boy, and you're sitting around the campfire in this really large wilderness area, and your scoutmaster's telling you stories about how, you know, if you're not careful, you find, you know, people would go and look for these mines, but they were guarded by the Native Americans. And sometimes, you know, they would take shots at you and scare you off and all these things. And, you know, so he tells you these stories and, you know, they seem like fun campfire stories. But when you dig into them a little bit more, as I did, you know, researching the book, they're absolutely true, these stories. And even though they seem like they would just be fun stories, there's a really big element of fact to these. And so where we get this fact is it's really interesting. So the Mormons had been in Salt Lake City for about 2 years. So in 1849, around that time, they're in Salt Lake. They're building the city. You know, everything's going okay, but they have kind of a big problem in that they don't have a way to trade with settlers going along the trails heading to Oregon or to California, and they also don't have a way to get goods from back east. You know, they have kind of a self-sufficient economy in the Great Salt Lake Valley, but they don't really have a means of trade, and so, or of, you know, exchange with people passing through. And so, you know, they're kind of having this cash crunch. Well, one day on June 14th, 1849, about 2 years after they got into the valley, a large contingent of Ute Indians rides into Salt Lake City. And this is all documented. This is all in the archives of the Mormon Church, and it was written in the paper at the time. And at the head of this group of Native Americans was one of the most powerful chiefs of the region. His name was Yakera. And the trappers and the people who dealt with him, the Americans, they couldn't really say Yakera very well, and so it kind of turned into Walker. So that's the anglicized version of his name. And so Chief Walker rides into town with a large contingent of his people, and he wants to meet with the Mormon leader, Brigham Young. And so Brigham Young had always tried to have good relationships with the Native Americans. I mean, there were obviously problems, there always were, but, you know, he tried to have good relations. So, of course, he met Walker, and Walker at first said, "Hey, you know, I just want to find out what your intentions are here." And, you know, he starts, you know, just talking about what the Mormons want to do there. And then as Chief Walker looks around the group, he sees this man, and he looks at him and he says, "You, I have seen you in a vision." And everyone's kind of taken aback here. It's like, okay. And the man that he saw in a vision was named Isaac Morley. And so they start to talk, and Chief Walker says to Isaac Morley, he says, "You know, I had a vision several years ago where I was told that I'm supposed to give you gold." Hmm. And everybody was kind of taken aback, like, okay, that's exactly what they needed at the time. And so it's very interesting. As the story comes out, what had happened to Chief Walker is that when he was a younger man, he was a very dashing and imposing figure, even as a young man. He had led these raids against the Spanish. He would, in all the way in California, and he would raid their horses and do different things. The Spanish really feared Walker, but they also respected him at the same time. And
he was gutsy.
He was. He had a lot of guts. He was an amazing person. And it's kind of sad. We see this a lot. He's probably one of the most important people in early history of the state of Utah. Like, he had a big imprint on the state, Chief Walker did. And as typically our Native people and Native heroes are kind of ignored, there's about a half a paragraph about him in the Utah history book that my son had this year in seventh grade. And I was looking at it and I'm like, oh, Chief Walker, he did so much more. But it's, you know, that's one of the problems with the mainstream, is they do seem to ignore Native legends and stories.
Yeah,
and Native
exactly.
Heroes.
Now, in searching for some of these lost treasures and legends, did anybody ever find anything?
Well, they did. And so as the story goes on with Walker, is he'd had a vision as a younger man where he, you know, he'd done all these amazing things. You know, it said he stole 6,000 horses one time from the Spanish and brought them back to his people. And he kind of had, it wasn't really a midlife crisis, but he was younger. He was in his 20s, and he wanted to know what his destiny was. You know, he was young, he was dashing, he was brave, but what was his destiny? And so he went up to a place in the Uintas, the place where we used to go camping as scouts, and to a place called Spirit Lake. And Spirit Lake is still there. You can still visit it. He did a vision quest. He sat up on a precipice overlooking the lake. He fasted, he chanted, he prayed. He was trying to know what the Great Spirit wanted him to do. Well, after several days of this, he suddenly has a vision where the Great Spirit shows him a group of people and says, you know, I am going to make you the keeper of a very important treasure. And not only is there treasure there, but there is the relics of the ancient ones. And this is kind of a very important part of the story is, you know, not only is he talking about gold, but there's relics of the ancient ones, whatever that means. So then the Great Spirit goes on to tell him, I'm going to make you the guardian of this treasure, and one day I want you to give some of it to the High Hats. And he was kind of confused. Walker was confused at this, that what the High Hats actually meant. So he goes on, and you know, this was long before the Mormons came to Utah, and so he wondered what this prophecy meant, what this destiny was for him. And so he encountered some of the Spanish coming up, and some of them wore kind of pointy hats, and he thought, well, are they the High Hats that I'm supposed to give this gold to? But he saw that a lot of the Spanish conquistadors and the people that were coming up were really greedy and really violent, and there was a lot of slavery. A lot of Native Americans were captured by the Spanish to use as slaves. And so he thought, no, that can't be the people that I'm supposed to give this gold to. And then later, the trappers came, Jim Bridger, these people. But they weren't interested in gold at all. They just wanted beaver pelts and these different things.
No gold? How could they not be interested in gold?
For the trappers, the fur.
That was gold for them.
That was gold to them. That's how they made their fortunes. Yeah, they really weren't interested in the minerals. And so Walker was still really confused. And then one day he got really, really sick. And the people actually thought he was dead. But when he was in this really sick state, he had an out-of-body experience. And if we use coast-to-coast lingo here, he had an out-of-body experience. He floated out of his body. He floated up over the clouds, and he saw down. He saw these wagons coming across the plains. And the Great Spirit said, those are the people you're supposed to give the gold to, or to help out with the gold. And they had high silk hats. And so if everyone goes to, or if everyone wants to go to my Facebook page, the Lost Mine Facebook page, there's a picture of Brigham Young that's hanging in his house that you can still go to in Salt Lake. And you can see the tall hats that they wore. They look like top hats or the magician hats. They were tall silk hats. And so the Great Spirit said, those are the people you're supposed to give the gold to. And so he came back into his body, and everyone was kind of surprised to see him, you know, alive again and doing well. And a few years later, the people came. And so when he had that audience with Brigham Young, he saw the person that he was supposed to give the gold to. And so to your question, did anybody find any of this treasure? The answer is yes. So Walker agreed with Brigham Young that there would be one person from the Mormons selected that he would be shown where the gold is, and he was allowed to travel there to this place where it was, and he was just able to kind of pick up what he could. He wasn't supposed to mine any himself. He was just supposed to pick up what he could and then bring it back. And so the guy who kept making these trips was named Thomas Rhodes. And this is all, you know, this is all documented in the newspapers at the time. It's documented in the records of the Mormon Church at the time. Thomas Rhodes would leave Salt Lake City with a few pack horses. He would go towards the Uinta Mountains, and 14 days later, he would come back, and he would have between 50 and 60 pounds of gold. And he wasn't gone long enough to mine it. He wasn't, you know, he just, wherever he went, he gathered it up and brought some back. And so you know, yes, this treasure that the Great Spirit told Chief Walker to guard, there's records of it being brought back to Salt Lake.
Now, Montezuma's lost treasure, that's something different, right?
Well, that's...
Or is it related?
That's the very interesting point, and that's like the question of the day. And so Montezuma's lost treasure could be related to this. And if you remember, I talked about how when the Great Spirit gave Chief Walker his vision, he talked about the relics of the old ones. And so let me kind of explain what Montezuma's lost treasure is, and then we can see how these two things might be connected. So Montezuma was the ruler of the Aztec Empire in the 1500s. And what's interesting, we often think about the Aztecs as this really, really ancient civilization. Well, it's kind of a mind-bending fact that Oxford University in England is actually older than the Aztec Empire.
Really?
Yeah, and it's funny to think about.
How can that be?
Well, Oxford was founded in about 1095 AD. The Aztec Empire was founded, their capital was founded in 1325. So Oxford is technically older. It's kind of funny to think about that you could still go to Oxford today, but the Aztec Empire is gone.
Now, is anybody guarding any of these mines?
Well, that's yes.
In a nutshell, right?
Yeah, in a nutshell. And let me go back to Montezuma's treasure, because that'll kind of link into how it goes. And so Montezuma was the ruler of the Aztec Empire. They had it, from his capital of Tenochtitlan. I probably slaughtered that. So any Spanish speakers out there, I apologize. The city of Tenochtitlan was an amazing city. It was the only cities in Europe that were bigger than it were Paris, Venice, and Constantinople. There was 140,000 inhabitants of Tenochtitlan, and it was built on this lake. It was a beautiful lake, and there was causeways leading there and gardens, and it was just an amazing palace.
What happened to them?
Well, what happened is the Spanish landed.
Ah, yes.
So Cortez, the conquistador, landed in 1519. And it's one of the interesting facts that, you know, some different people on coast to coast have brought up over the years, is that Cortez only had a small army, and the Aztec army was magnificent. But the Aztecs believed, or at least were thinking, that when Cortez showed up, that he was actually the god Quetzalcoatl, having returned to Earth. You know,
basically bowed down to him.
They did, and they tried to appease him at first, but when they tried to appease him, they brought large discs of gold to him, and that just whetted his appetite.
Yeah, like, and then he probably figured out, where is this stuff coming from?
Right. Right? He wanted more, and so, you know, a lot of people present it like the Aztecs were like, oh, he's a god, and they just instantly bent, you know, bowed down to him, and there was some of that, but they were more just kind of being careful. Like, I think a lot of them saw, this guy is kind of, you know, greedy, and he has different motives, but they're like, but maybe he's Quetzalcoatl, and so they acquiesced to him to be careful. Now, another trouble for the Aztecs is the Aztecs were magnificent, but they were also extremely cruel. And so a lot of the smaller tribes that have been conquered are like, hey, you know, if this Cortez is going to go after the Aztecs, maybe we'll help him out. And so he did get some of the indigenous people, Cortez, to be on his side. Well, anyway, when he gets to Tenochtitlan, he basically puts Montezuma under house arrest and orders that everybody in the whole city deliver all of their gold and silver to him. And so the people brought some of it to him, but the bulk of the treasure they hid in these vaults that were under several of the palaces in the city, and they hid it from Cortez. And it's described as just being a treasure so magnificent but you can't even comprehend it. One of the Spanish spies who saw it said that, you know, he could not believe that any earthly ruler would have such a treasure. There was bars of gold and jewels and pearls and just all these amazing things. And so they were hiding it from Cortez. Well, Cortez, you know, he's very greedy, he wants it, and he's sending around spies, and he's about ready to discover it, but a courier arrived and said, hey, some other Spanish troops have arrived, and they're trying to depose you, Cortez. They want to steal Mexico from you. So Cortez rushes away from Tenochtitlan to fight these other Spanish invaders.
With just a few men. He didn't have that many.
Right, he didn't have a lot, but he took what he had to go fight off the invaders, and he left just kind of a skeleton force in Tenochtitlan. Well, while Cortez is away, the Aztecs are like, hey, can we have this festival that we have every year at this time, where, you know, it was a festival honoring their patron god of war. And the Spanish said, well, fine, but you can't do human sacrifices and you can't have your swords, but yeah, if you want to have your dancers.
No heads.
Yeah, no heads. So, you know, they said, you can have this celebration with just the dancers. And so 600 dancers go into the streets of Tenochtitlan. They're arrayed in feathers and just beautiful. They're dancing, they're honoring their god of war. But then the Spanish notice that these 600 dancers all have gold necklaces.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And so they're enraged because they didn't turn over the gold like they were supposed to. And so the Spanish slaughtered these 600 dancers just right there in the streets.
Wiped them all out.
Yep, cut them down.
Oh, my God.
And it said that...
For the gold.
Yeah, for the gold, just for their gold chains that they had on their necks, their gold necklaces. And it said that the streets were running, you know, with blood like a...
Of
like
course.
It well, that kind of proved that merciless slaughter proved to the Aztecs once and for all that, like, you know, these
aren't good people.
Yeah,
these and they're not gods.
Right. They're not gods. They're not here for us. So there was an uprising. And so they pinned the few Spanish soldiers that were there in one of the palaces. And while this was all going on, Montezuma arranged for 1,500 or so special porters to take the treasure that was hidden in these secret vaults and then carry it up what they called the Trail of the Old Ones up north.
So there was a treasure. We're going to come back. We'll talk about that, Paul, and we'll take calls as well next.